Out of fear of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the rivers flow and the ocean never overflows. Out of him only does the fire burn, and does the earth with its mountains not sink in the water of the universe. Report by Srila Prabhupada. We can understand from the Vedic literature that this universe is half filled with water, on which Garbhodakshayi Vishnu is lying. From his abdomen, a lotus flower has grown, and within the stem of that lotus flower, all the different planets exist. The material scientist explains that all these different planets are floating because the law of gravity, or some other law. But the actual lawmaker is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When we speak of law, we must understand that there must be a lawmaker. The material scientists can discover laws of nature, but they are unable to recognize the lawmaker. From Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, we can know who the lawmaker is. The lawmaker is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is said here that the planets do not sink. Since they are floating under the order or energy of the Supreme Godhead, they do not fall down into the water which covers half the universe. All the planets are heavy with their various mountains, seas, oceans, cities, palaces, and buildings, and yet they are floating. It is understood from this passage that all the other planets that are floating in the air have oceans and mountains similar to those on this planet. So we have a verse that deals with two basic topics, which Srila Prabhupada addresses in the purport. The first, of course, has to do with the basic cause underlying different material phenomena. So the verse is saying that these phenomena are taking place out of fear of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Srila Prabhupada, in the purport, points out that one has to postulate some lawmaker to explain the laws governing material nature. So the scientific conception of the universe holds that there are different laws of nature, and phenomena are unfolding in accordance with these laws. So in its extreme form, this gives rise to a concept of material reductionism, according to which everything that happens is determined by the laws of nature. Or more specifically, in the way it's usually been explained, if you know the state of affairs in the material world at a given moment in time, then the laws of nature completely determine what is going to happen next. And then that gives you a new state of affairs. So the laws then determine what will happen after that, and so on. So the result is everything is rigidly governed by a set of laws of nature. This is the concept that you find in physics. So the problem with this conception, of course, is that it eliminates God as the direct controller and supervisor of the material manifestation. Because if everything is exactly happening according to laws, that means there's no question of conscious choice in determining what happens. It's all just going step by step according to the laws. Even if the laws originally were created by this supreme lawmaker. So this gives you the philosophy which is known as deism historically. This philosophy became quite popular after the time of Isaac Newton. And in fact, the founding fathers of the United States were very proud to be deists, people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and so forth. So that idea acknowledges that the laws of nature are produced by a lawmaker, but it makes the laws absolute. So that once the lawmaker has created the material universe, in effect, it's like a clock that he built, wound up, and set into motion, and then didn't deal with from then on. And the clock just continued ticking according to the laws built into its structure. So in more recent developments within science, there's been a tendency to drop this conception. Interestingly enough, the idea that the laws of nature are deterministic has also been dropped by modern-day physicists. They now introduce an element of pure chance into the laws of nature, so that they say that some events occur purely by chance. Some people have taken this as a loophole through which you can introduce some kind of divine control. However, control by a conscious being and events happening by chance are two radically different concepts. And the ironic thing here is that it turns out that there are laws of chance. This, of course, is something well known to insurance companies and gambling casinos. In fact, gambling casinos make their profits based on the laws of chance. They arrange various gambling games so that they have a statistical edge, and you can calculate by the laws of chance that they're sure to make a profit. Of course, if by a chance fluctuation they don't make a profit on a given occasion, they can always resort to more draconian measures and give somebody concrete overshoes, as they say. So this is chance enforced by determinism. In any case, the physicists now are saying that events of pure chance are occurring. So if you have, let's say, a piece of radioactive substance, and you put a Geiger counter next to it, and you hear random clicks, these occur entirely by chance, according to the quantum theory, as it's known. But this is actually incompatible with the idea that the clicks are expressing the intention of some higher controller. For example, suppose the clicks spell out a message in some code, and you receive the message. Well, if that happened, you certainly wouldn't say that the clicks were happening by chance. You would conclude that somebody must be sending you a message, and that it's not by chance. So, that is the situation today. So in the field of physical science, even though a determinism has been eliminated, even the idea that there's an original lawmaker has been eliminated, although some scientists have continued to wonder about this topic. For example, this famous physicist Stephen Hawking, who has the Lou Gehrig's disease, is continually thinking about the question of God. Basically, God for him represents a problem. And his idea is that if he can formulate the laws of nature in a completely self-contained way, then he can eliminate God from the picture and say that there's nothing there but the laws of nature. But even he raised the question that, all right, if you have these laws, which you might express in terms of equations, what, as he put it, breathes fire into the equations and gives you an actual universe for them to describe? Because you can talk about some set of laws, but how do you bring about a real world in which those laws are being followed? And he admitted he had no explanation for that. So, that's a summary of the present state of affairs. Of course, if you look at material nature, you can argue that there is evidence not only that there's a lawmaker, but that that lawmaker is continuously intervening in the material phenomena. Basically, this is what is called the argument from design. If you look at matter as it is constituted in accordance with the laws of physics, what you see is that material order and structure tend to break down. This is called the second law of thermodynamics by the physicists. But basically, if there is order and organization, in due course of time, that tends to disintegrate. So if that's the basic tendency of matter, then first of all, where did all the order that we see come from in the first place? Why would matter, which tends to break down order, have produced order. And given that that order was there, then it should be steadily decreasing. We should have less and less of it. The material world should become more and more chaotic. But we don't see that either. So the inference is that there must be some ongoing source of order. There must be some power that is continuing to organize the material energy. So that would be God, ultimately. So those are a few observations on the first part of the purport. Srila Prabhupada goes on to address the point here that was made about the planets sinking. I suspect that's why I was asked to talk about this verse. So, out of fear of him only does the earth with its mountains not sink in the water of the universe. So, there's a lot that can be said about the basic system of Vedic cosmology. I'll just briefly make a few observations. The basic geometric structure of the universe is described in the Bhagavatam, is that you have a sphere called the Brahmanda, and that sphere is cut in half by a plane. Now this plane is called the Earth, or Bhu-loka. And the plane, actually it's not exactly a plane, it's a sheet with a certain degree of thickness, quite thin though relative to the diameter of the sphere. And it's divided into eight different levels. Those would be seven lower planetary systems, and then the eighth topmost level would be Bhumandala, or the middle planetary system. So basically that is a very thin plate or disk. Beneath that you have water. That's the water that's referred to here, which is called the Garbhadak Ocean. And then above that you have a region of space called Antariksha. Curiously, this word Antariksha means inner space. We tend to speak of outer space, but Antar means inside. So you have the inner space, and then above that, you have a series of higher planets, Svargaloka, Maharloka, and so on, up to Satyaloka within the universe. So that is the basic description. Also, this whole system is compared to an embryo. The word Brahmanda means Brahma egg, because Anda is egg. And Garbhadak, well, Garbha is embryo. So the Garbhadak ocean is the embryonic ocean. In fact, you can see that the universe in that sense is structured like an egg, because the Garbhadak ocean would be like the amniotic fluid in the egg. And sure enough, you have what looks like an umbilical cord inside this egg, because Garbhadakshai Vishnu produces the lotus, which is coming out of his navel. The lotus unfolds, and Brahma takes birth from the lotus. And Srila Prabhupada pointed out that as he said here, did he say it here, or? Not in this particular purport, that the planets are within the stem of this lotus. So this aspect of the universe is there. The Bhagavatam gives quite a few details about this basic structure. And from that you can see that the disk of Bhumandala basically plays a number of different roles. One of those I described recently in a BTG article. Bhumandala turns out to be a map of the solar system. And this is a quite remarkable thing, as it turns out. The surface of Bhumandala is inscribed with a series of ring-shaped features, which are called oceans and dvipas. Dwipa is usually translated as island, and literally Dwipa means water on two sides. So each of these ring-shaped subdivisions has an ocean on the inside and an ocean on the outside. So in effect, it has water on two sides of the ring. So the radii of these dwipas are given in the Bhagavatam, and it turns out that they correlate very nicely with the geocentric orbits of the planets, so that in effect, Bhumandala is a map of the solar system. And this is factual. Someone might want to argue that it must be coincidental, because surely the person who wrote the Bhagavatam couldn't have known about something like that. But whatever you might want to say there, the fact is that the Bhumandala is a map of the solar system, and it's quite accurate. My own inclination would be to think that the author of the Bhagavatam did understand what he was doing, and that this is quite deliberate. This implies that in ancient times, when the Bhagavatam was written, there was advanced knowledge of astronomy in the modern sense. That is, people knew how far away the planets were, how they moved in their orbits, and so forth. And they knew this with considerable precision. So that's one aspect of Bhumandala. But that's not the entire story. Bhumandala also corresponds to a map of the Earth globe. And this is another whole story that one would have to go into, and I won't spend too much time on it. But, of course, we have experienced that the Earth is a globe, and some of us have flown all the way around it in jet planes. That's customary for devotees to do. If you go to India by the Pacific route and the European route, then the result is you've actually gone all the way around the world, at least once. So, in the Bhagavatam, the Earth, or Jambudvipa, which is part of Bhumandala, is described as a flat disk. So there's a explanation here, which has actually been discussed at some length in a number of different published papers on the subject, namely that the Jambudvipa as a flat disk is a polar projection map of the Earth. And one can go into considerable detail showing how Jambudvipa correlates with the Earth. Furthermore, the motion of the sun and the moon and so forth relative to Jambudvipa can be understood in terms of this idea of the polar projection. For example, in some of the Puranas, it is described that in the course of the year, the sun crosses over the different dwipas, coming in and then out. And it moves faster when it's in the southern part of its orbit, slower when it's in the northern part, and so forth. To explain this in more detail, I'd need to show some diagrams. But basically, this exactly corresponds to the pattern of motion that the sun would have, given that you have a polar projection. And the ecliptic is mapped onto the Earth, between the two circles, the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. So there's a lot of detail behind this also, but this is another aspect of Bhumandala. So a third aspect of Bhumandala is that it's a description of the realm of the demigods. So actually, the major part of the description in the Bhagavatam is dedicated to this aspect. So what this is basically saying is that coextensive with this physical structure of the Brahmanda, which corresponds to the Earth and the solar system and so forth, there is a world of beings that we don't directly see, but which has structure within space. And this is the realm of the demigods. It's described in the Bhagavatam that there are three categories of heaven. It's interesting, we speak of the three worlds. That's a common phrase which is used. They're all called Svarga, interestingly enough. So there's the higher planets, including specifically Svarga Loka, and this is referred to as Divya Svarga, or Svarga of the demigods. Then all of Bhumandala and Jambudvip, except for Bharatvarsha, is referred to as Bauma Svarga. And beneath Bhumandala, you have the lower planetary systems, and that's referred to as Bila Svarga, which is a rather curious phrase, because Bila literally, well, it's translated as subterranean in the Bhagavatam, and literally it means in a hole. So you have a subterranean heaven, which sounds like a contradiction in terms. But actually what it refers to is that the Bauma Svarga corresponds to the plane of the solar system. Divya Svarga corresponds to what is to the north of that in the celestial sense. And Bila Svarga is to the south of that in the celestial sense. So you divide up the space within that sphere into three parts, to the north, in the middle, and to the south. And that corresponds to these three heavens. And actually they are heavens because they're all out there in space. Bharatvarsha, however, is defined as an exception in the Bhagavatam. And that is the only part of the entire universe in which it is said that ordinary human beings are to be found. Because in the Bhagavatam it says that Bharatvarsha is the place of karma. And it is the place where you find people with mixed karma. Some of them are highly elevated, some of them are just ordinary people, others are extremely abominable in their character. So at the same time, Bharatvarsha is described as a place where there's great opportunity for spiritual advancement, and the demigods pray that they could take birth there, even though they're living in the heavenly regions. Now this Bharatvarsha, in that sense, corresponds to the entire earth that we experience. If you look at the remainder of Jambudvip, and Bharatvarsha is just part of Jambudvip, there are nine varshas, or subdivisions, of which Bharatvarsha is the southernmost. The other eight subdivisions are characterized as places where beings are living who have come down from the heavenly planets, but they still have basically, you might say, demigod karma, which they're living out. And so they live for about 10,000 years. They don't experience any degeneration of the body. They don't grow old. Their bodies don't smell or get gray hair or wrinkles or anything like that. They're as strong as 10,000 elephants and all this sort of thing. Of course, I wonder, I think the elephants there are probably also stronger. So maybe they're as strong as 10,000 of our elephants. So in any case, that is the description. So these are heavenly regions. And of course, we don't see anything like that here on the earth. So this is also an aspect of the description in the fifth canto. Now, you can say that there's a horizontal direction within the universe and a vertical direction. Horizontal would be in the plane of Bhumandala, and vertical would be perpendicular to that. Vertical means in the direction of north. The opposite of that, down, would be towards the south. Interestingly enough, at either end of the vertical axis, you have Lord Vishnu stationed. Going in the upward direction, you come to Dhruva Loka, which is described as the planet of Lord Vishnu. And the entire section of the sky from the Big Dipper to the north, if you go out at night, you can see this. If you look there, you'll see the Big Dipper. So take us and find the pole star. So if you take the pole star, go to the Big Dipper and draw a circle of that radius. All of the stars contained in that circle correspond to what is called Vishnupada, which is the path of Lord Vishnu, the center of that being the pole star or Dhruva Loka. And then basically the planets, which you can also see at night, go through what is called the ecliptic area of the sky, where the constellations of the zodiac are found. And everything from that north up to the Big Dipper, moving in celestial north, would be called the Devayana, which is the path of the gods, the demigods. And going in the other direction, south from the area in which the planets are rotating, going down as far south as Agastya, which is the star Canopus, which is at about 60 degrees south, actually. That's called the Pitriyana path, the path of the Pitris. And there's the description in the Bhagavad Gita that depending on when you die, you may take the Devayana path or the Pitriyana path. So the Devayana path goes in the direction of Vishnu Loka, and the Pitriyana path goes in the direction of the Pitri Loka. But this is all out in the sky, interestingly enough. And that makes sense because Bhumandala extends through the sky, and everything to the north of that would be in the demigod direction, and to the south of that, underneath Bhumandala, you have Pitri Loka. But going a bit further to the south, you have the Garbhodak Ocean, and then you have there you have Garbhodakshay Vishnu and Anantashesha. So between, you could say basically there are two poles, both of which are Vishnu, between which all the planetary systems are distributed. So that's the system. But since that is the case, this is all in a higher dimension. In other words, Garbhodakshay Vishnu is on the Garbhodak Ocean, but not as a physical body that we could see if we had a sufficiently powerful telescope or anything like that. In fact, it's described that Brahma himself could not see Garbhodakshay Vishnu when he first awoke to consciousness and tried to trace out his origin. It's described that he was able to understand that the lotus had some source, and he followed the stem down towards the water, but he couldn't see what was down there. It was impossible for him. So we, of course, have these paintings where you see Garbhodakshay Vishnu and the lotus and Lord Brahma, and we see all those things. But Lord Brahma himself couldn't see all that until later on, by the grace of Lord Vishnu, he was given that vision. So this vertical axis of the universe has its higher dimensional aspect. So I think I'll stop there. Those are a few observations on the universe. Any questions, comments? Merle.
My first question. When you explain the deism,
yeah,
and how come the clock analogy, but it seems to me as an understanding of philosophy that it's more than just a clock. It's if God creates absolute laws, my question is, does he himself become then subject to those laws?
Well, you can argue, if you like, that God does not become subject to the laws since he's completely transcendental. But everything material is subject to those laws. So the analogy is like somebody building a clock, setting it in motion, and walking away. He doesn't come back to the clock. It just moves deterministically according to its mechanism.
Theoretically, he could not.
Well, there was a famous argument between Newton and Leibniz. Newton said that the clockmaker could come back and readjust the clock. In fact, he said that happens. And Leibniz said that this is actually sacrilege, because you're saying that God is such an imperfect craftsman that he makes a clock that he has to come back and adjust. Just like an ordinary clock where you have to reset the time periodically. So Leibniz rejected that. But in principle, God could come back and and reset the clock. Yeah.
I have a question about Newton also and the deism. There's a story about Newton making a model of the universe and some friends saying, who made it? And Newton said, nobody. Mm-hmm. And he said, why? Yeah, well, he said, no one made this universe. Is that a story or two?
I don't know if that particular event involving the model of the universe ever really took place, but it is a fact that Newton defended the position that the universe was created by God. Newton was quite a curious character. It turns out he wrote one book on physics, which is very famous, the Principia Mathematica, and so on. He wrote dozens of books on theology. But curiously enough, nobody ever wanted to publish them. And his books on theology are still in his own handwriting in some museum somewhere. But nobody published them. Another funny thing about Newton is that he spent 30 years of his life studying alchemy, which is very embarrassing to scientists, because their hero spent 30 years on alchemy. So anyway, yeah?
Could you explain what the polar projection?
Oh, polar projection. If you look in an atlas, all the maps are flat. So, but the Earth is a globe. Now, the curved surface of the Earth, if you flatten that out to create a flat map, you have to do what is called make a projection of some kind. And that inevitably distorts the shape of the different continents. And there are many different ways to do it. What we usually see with a map is a Mercator projection, in which the equator is a horizontal line going down the center. If you look, you'll see Greenland is very stretched out at the top, and Antarctica is stretched along the bottom, and so forth. Now, if you make the North Pole the center, and you basically take the Earth and flatten it up around the North Pole, that gives you a polar projection. And you'll find those kinds of maps in atlases also. So basically, Jambudweep corresponds to a polar projection of the Earth. So that's another aspect of Jambudweep. Yeah?
You were saying that, it sounded like you were saying that actually things are in, becoming more disordered in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was remembering wrong that studying thermodynamics, it said that entropy is always increasing, so in fact, they were claiming this order was going on. So is that no longer held, or are you just taking a radical, different than what Solomon said?
Well, you could say that I'm taking a radical approach. You see, the scientists introduced the theory of evolution to reconcile the second law of thermodynamics with the fact that we do seem to see more order than supposedly was there, say, 100 million years ago, or whatever time you might like. So, and this leads to a bit of a problem. How more and more order can come about, even though matter tends to become disordered. So they have their theory with chance and natural selection, survival of the fittest, and so on. And I won't go into it, but I would argue extensively that the theory doesn't work. So they're stuck with the fact that things should get more disordered, I would propose. But if we look at the world, we see a great deal of order there. So how's that coming about? That is the basic question. There's more order than they postulate for the past. Consider the primordial Earth, the way they would talk about it. Well, you've got oceans and the atmosphere and volcanoes erupting, and you have different chemicals floating in the water, and that's it. No life. And they will say, well, the molecules collide with one another, and they happen to form different configurations, which lead to further configurations, and somehow a living cell is formed, which reproduces itself. And then the cells that function better reproduce more efficiently, so there are more of them around, and so on and so forth, and you wind up with us finally talking about it. So it's actually a difficult theory to defend. So, anything else? Yeah?
Is Brahma Loka on the where Satya Loka is, or is it where is Brahma?
Brahma Loka is Satya Loka, at least according to one meaning of the word. It's the same thing. Another meaning of Brahma Loka is the Brahma Jyoti. Sometimes the word is used in that sense. So, but I was using it to refer to the place where Brahma lives, which would be the same as Satya Loka. Which, by the way, is described, let's see, is described in the Bhagavatam as avachmanasa, which means beyond words and the mind. This is Satya Loka. So try and make a model of it. So, okay, one more.
Talking about gravity, and I'm just wondering exactly what is the way to understand gravity, because you see that Prabhupada describes how the planets are floating because of the oil that's contained in it. And also in our practical observation, we see lizards walking across the roof and jumping down to catch insects and going back up to the roof. That is what the Vedic concept is.
The Vedic concept of gravity. Well, all the Vedic scientific, Vedic astronomical texts say that the planets are moved by an arrangement of air. So some arrangement involving air would be the Vedic equivalent of gravity in that sense. There are different types of wind which are described, the Pravaha wind, for example. The Surya Siddhanta describes the planets moving according to ropes of air. So that's basically where you'd have to look to understand the Vedic idea of gravity. Yeah?
There's a verse about how the oceans don't go any further by fear of Krishna. I can understand how everything is personified. But is that Krishna saying now, this is as far as you go, and that's it? That was really going on.
Is that really going on? Well, this, unfortunately, it's a little bit late to get into the whole subject of the relation between personalities, which seem to be sort of idiosyncratic is the word that comes to mind. They act according to their desire, which is based on all kinds of complicated situations, and so it's really hard to anticipate what a person is going to do. Now, you can contrast that with regular behavior of matter in nature. For example, the tides of the ocean. The tide comes in to a certain point and it goes out and so on, which is explained in terms of the gravitational pull of the moon in modern science. And by the way, in the Puranas, there are quite a few different statements which say that the tides are caused by the moon. So that's recognized in Vedic literature also. So what do those regular phenomena have to do with personalities? It would seem a personality would get bored if all he had to do was just sort of move the tides in and out forever. Or consider the idea of the sun god going around in his orbit. I mean, such a highly intelligent, qualified being, and all he's doing is going in circles day after day. You'd think that would become a bit tedious after a while. So what is the relationship? So I'll leave that as a homework problem. So anyway, there's a lot that could be said about that. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.